Good morning and welcome to the August 25th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
You can feel fall and you're starting to begin to see it up in the mountains. A few leaves are changing. So sit down, have a cup of coffee, because we're going to be talking about coffee, among other things, this morning. We're going to start our show today by speaking with filmmaker Rob Diamond about his career as an independent filmmaker.
And then we'll speak with Tyler Anderson at what's the name of his place?
He's the founder of Urban Sailor Coffee.
That's
I'm actually drinking a cup. I picked one up on the way in this morning.
Did you?
I did.
You picked one up, not two, huh?
I think I see some in his hand out there, Kevin.
Awesome. Love to hear that. And then we're going to be joined by Polly Bykova and Crystal Deakins. They've opened up Mixers and More down at the bottom of Swede Alley. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. On August 8th, we got a press release from the Utah Film Commission about six film productions that have been approved to receive state film incentives from the Utah Board of Tourism Development. These productions will generate an estimated economic impact of $7.1 million and over 400 jobs. One of those six films is Gabriella, a family film by Utah local filmmaker Rob Diamond. We are fortunate to be joined by Rob Diamond on our show this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so can you tell us a little bit about Gabriella?
Yeah, it's a script I co-wrote with a girl named Teresa Melendez, and it's about a little girl who's born into some pretty tough hardships, and she has a near-death experience, and she's been given the opportunity to stay on Earth or go back to another world. And if she decides to stay, she's given powers to heal. And if she chooses to stay, those powers, if she uses those powers, it comes at a cost. And so it's a heartfelt, emotional family drama that is near and dear to my heart. We wrapped on it already. We just wrapped about 2 weeks ago.
Full-length feature film?
Full-length feature, yeah. It'll get a worldwide distribution.
Okay, and who's distributing it?
I'm still deciding. I have numerous distribution companies that I've developed relationships over the years. I'm going to see who's most excited about it and who gives me the best deal. And so even before I go make a film now, I'm in a place in my career where I'll go to people and see if it's in their wheelhouse. I've done family, faith-based, mainstream dramas. I've done a lot of different genres in my career, and this has really piqued some interest. I did a film about 5 years ago called Lucy Shimmers and the Prince of Peace that went viral, and the same little girl that stars in that stars in this, so I have people really excited about it.
And what genre would you put this in?
Faith-based family genre.
Okay.
So I understand you've been making films in Utah for 25 years.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
Yeah. Can you take a moment and share your film background with our listeners, you know, how you got started, where you got started, et cetera?
Yeah, I'm from California, and I started actually doing commercials, you know, and the print industry when I was young. I was a surfer. I'm from Southern California, Dana Point, and when I was 17, I was coming out of the water one day after a surfing session, and Coca-Cola approached me to do a commercial, and it was completely by accident. I was like, what's going on? And so they offered me some money, and it was kind of it was a summer love story, me and a girl walking on the pier hand in hand. And I fell into it, and I fell in love with the storytelling process. It was fun. It was fun being in front of the camera, modeling, doing commercials. But I wanted to shift my career. I wanted to get into writing and directing. I came out here to do a movie with Mickey Rooney in '97 called The Face on the Barroom Floor. I got cast in it. And soon after that, I was like, you know what? I need to do this. And so I wrote a script in 2 weeks. I raised 50 grand and I made it. And it was a horrible movie. But I learned by doing. You know, if we would have filmed behind the scenes, we filmed it here, Vegas, and we ended in California on the beach. And the behind the scenes would have been a wonderful little documentary. That's how I got indoctrinated. And I love film. I love watching movies. I love being moved. And I dove into it. And after that film, I took a breather and I waited a few years and needed to really start from the drawing board again. And I just did. And around that time, I started teaching film acting too. And so I would develop a lot of my scripts through my students doing scenes. And I just evolved. And I think I've done 20 something films. And I learned the hardships of filmmaking, that, you know, film is a business. you know, I'm an artist, I'm a creative artist by nature, and I'm a businessman by nurture. And so I really taken the time to develop relationships with people in distribution, people that I trust, that I know I'm going to get an ROI from my investors. And it's still a risk, but if you go into it trusting people and you know what your who your market is and who you're trying to please, then you could I could write scripts for that particular audience.
Yeah. So going back to Gabriella in that sense, how do you sort of visualize, you know, who's your target market and how will the distribution work to try to reach that target market?
Well, I think there's lots of markets, and I think I've noticed that in the particular faith-based market, I've noticed that movies surrounding little girls that have something special about them or going through hardships are something that has an appeal. I don't know why, but I did an early, after, you know, an early film I did probably in 2009 or 10, I did one called Elizabeth's Gift about a little girl, and it did really well. And so when I came up with Lucy Shimmers, it was about a little girl, and the Gabrielle is about a little girl. And my granddaughter is an actor, and she's the one who stars in Lucy Shimmers. And she's phenomenal. And not just because she's my granddaughter, but she's a natural. And when the camera's rolling, there's no difference between her when the camera's on or her when the camera's off. And when I teach acting, I teach a natural sort of acting to not act. It's different than stage. And when you see her in this movie, she just captured people's hearts. And I think I've done 4 or 5 films with her since that, and a couple of them are about to be released this year. One's being released in November called Forgiveness Girl, about a little girl with cerebral palsy. And then another one's called Lady in the Locket that she's in. It's a mainstream ghost story. And so
that's the ghost romance, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of a ghost. It's kind of a ghost romance. A girl who inherits an old mansion that her she thinks it's her aunt, was a movie star that retired to Utah, and there's a family secret. And when she dies, she leaves clues. She leaves this home to her niece, and she discovers the truth of the family secret, and it evolves into a love story about a guy who lost his wife. He's a cop in a small town. He has a little girl, and so I'm really excited about those releases. And but you know, I think genres, films are films. You know, people like different genres. Some people like faith. Some people like, you know, action. I did an action one, just a low budget little throwback Charles Bronson vigilante film called Shadow of Vengeance, and it's doing really well.
But to go back, I want to see if I can understand this.
Yeah.
When you're making something like a faith-based film,
yeah,
where are the income streams? Where, you know, how do you make money on
everything that you would see a normal film on?
Okay.
I have films on Tubi, on Peacock, on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
Numerous platforms. So it's
and theatrical release.
Yeah, some films go through a lot of films now. Theatrical. I think when I was younger, the theatrical release would appeal
to the be all and end all, right?
Yeah. Well, it would appeal more to my ego.
Yeah.
Now I just want it to be seen, and I want my investors to have a chance to get an ROI. So, you see, even big movie stars now, they're out in a film, and it's an Amazon Prime original, or it's a Tubi original, it's a Netflix original, and it doesn't even go to theater. Many films don't go to theater. Theater's great if you get some P&R dollars behind it, and it does well, but it's a risk. It's a risk for an investor. And so if I'm not dealing with big name stars, I would rather just, the star of my film is the genre. And now that I got my little granddaughter, Scarlett, people want to watch her, so she helps a lot.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's nice if you have the money to go theatrical, but that doesn't mean it's going to make money. It could hurt the investor's chance, because someone who invested in the film, they take second position if someone's coming in and doing print and advertising for theatrical release. So I'm very cautious with that. I want to protect my original investor's money, and if they want to come in and put some P&A dollars into a small theatrical release, that's fine. I've done that before.
So I assume your investors are invest multiple films.
They do.
Because
it takes time for movies to get out there and start trickling in money on a quarterly basis. And so I do have investors that have invested in multiple films, and it kind of spreads the risk.
Yeah.
It's what Hollywood does. You know, a big production, Warner Brothers or Universal, they're going to do 10 films knowing that one of them is going to be a blockbuster. 2 are going to do okay, 3 are going to break even, and a few are going to flop. And so I just try to be intelligent and thoughtful and cognitive about my investors' money. And I'm working on what Hollywood call micro budgets. I'm working between $100,000 and $300,000. And these films look like they're made for $1 million. You could make a beautiful film now if you do it right. If you write a good story and you cast it properly, you get good locations and you get good cinematographers and G&E and all the people, you can make a really beautiful film on $250,000.
Yeah. And films like that have to rely on story rather than CGI and silly special effects.
Yes, that's why I love old movies, because old movies relied on story. Mm-hmm. So I love stories. So I've invested a lot of my life and my time and my career to trying to be a good storyteller, because I don't have all the bells and whistles. I can do special effects. I do people that do it for me, but I can't do Superman.
Right. Yeah.
Or do I want to? I want the people out there. I appreciate it, but that's not where my heart is. My heart is in storytelling. So it works really well for me, independent film, and yeah. I have control.
So you write,
I do.
You produce,
and
you direct.
Yeah.
So you know you're kind of lazy.
Yeah.
You don't really get it.
Well, no. I also do the casting. I do the location scouting. I love that part of it. I love mm-hmm. like when I write a script, I'm thinking about locations, and I love to go out and meet people and shake their hand and look them in the eye and go, hey, I'm a local filmmaker. I need this location, because there's a lot of times I'll go back. Mm-hmm. I need that. So I leave it. I develop relationships, and I leave the location better than when I found it. I'm not trying to go and just leave a mess for someone else to pick up. This is where I live. This is my backyard. And I want the next filmmaker to have that experience, a good experience for that location to be opened up to them.
So how long is the process? On average, from the moment, you know, pen hits paper to the moment it is showing on.
Great question. I call that concept to screen, and I teach it. So it's usually about 8 months to a year from the time I start writing that script to the time that it hits streaming.
Yeah, that's
sometimes a little bit longer depending on how much post-production I have. But my goal is I want to, like this film I just filmed this summer, I want it released next summer. And so I just have a strategic plan from the writing of it, development of it, the raising of the money, the pre-production, production, all the way through post-production until, like you said, it hits streaming.
Someone can click on it.
Someone
now, do you also edit?
I don't. I hire editors. I have three or four editors that I work with, depend on genres and what I'm working on and what they're working on. I have two or three cinematographers I love to use. I have colorists. I have a team of people that I'll use. A lot of them I use again and again. But when it comes to editing, I have about four editors that I use.
Gotcha. Yeah. So we had Yellowstone shooting here in town a few years ago.
And now we got Y. Marshall's coming back.
Yeah.
Which I'm super happy for the market. Yeah, I'm really stoked about
it. It's
great.
Like you said, the locations around here are absolutely
beautiful. Locations, and the cast and crew are really good. And so I think, you know, I'm bummed we lost Sundance, but it doesn't mean we're going to lose people coming in to make movies. It might have affected the market for 2 weeks, which I'm sad for people who were relying on that boost in the market, but it's not going to stop people from coming to make movies. They were coming here, Robert Redford was coming here before Sundance because he loved the locations.
Yeah.
When he did Jeremiah Johnson and Butch Cassidy, all those. And so we're going to continue to see people come in here, and Y. Marshall is a good example. I own an agency too, so I just got a big breakdown. There are 15 parts they're looking for. So this is big, and I support indie film. I support low-budget film. I support big-budget film. I just love cinema, and I love that I could contribute in my own small way to this market.
So you use local cast and crew.
I do, mostly.
Yeah, do you import anyone from California?
I do. Okay. Like I've done films where I've worked with name actors. I've cast Danny Trejo before in some of my movies.
Oh, yes.
Corbin Burnson. So I do from time to time. I'll bring some. I just did produced a psychological thriller called Mother and Me with a really talented young filmmaker. I think it's going to make a real splash in the film world. But I cast Brady Noon out of L.A. So I will on certain films bring name actors in, but 80 to 90% of the cast is local, and there's some real talent here.
And what about lighting, people, transportation, electrical,
all that here? Yeah, there's some very savvy crew here. G&E, Griffin Electric, there's some great cinematographers. Great places where you could get cameras, whether you're shooting on the red or the area or whatever it is. It's a great place.
We got the press release from the Utah Film Commission.
Yep.
How helpful is the Utah Film Commission to you as
to
a filmmaker?
To me, they treated me as if I was a big budget filmmaker. They treated me really well, and they made the process effortless. And so I just had a meeting with them the other day to wrap up all the details of you know, getting approved on this film for the tax incentive. And from beginning to end, their whole team was great. And I love that they've lowered it to where if you spend $100,000 here, you could qualify for the 20%. That helps indie filmmakers.
Yeah.
So between the $100,000 and the $500,000, that's worth it. So this last film I did was about $150,000 film. I'm gonna get $25,000 back. Mm-hmm. That covers my post.
Yeah.
That's a big deal to a guy like me, and sure. I think it's a big deal to any filmmaker that is receiving financial help on any part of the production. It's awesome.
Now, what about, have you received incentives from them before?
I haven't, because I've been working on these lower budgets, and that didn't apply.
Doesn't hit the threshold.
So now it works for me. So, I'm getting ready to do another film. I'm probably going to do Shadow of Vengeance too. Probably going to be a kind of $250,000, $300,000 film. I'll bring a few name actors in on that. That helps. Now you're talking about 50, 60, 70 grand to help me in various stages of production. And I think it's huge. I love what they're doing. I love what Utah do. I'm a big fan of Utah. I'm a big fan of the people in Utah. This business is about people. And it's a collaborative effort. And I love that. Utah Film Commission's always worked with me, whether it's locations. But this is the first one that I've been able to apply for the tax incentive.
Yeah, Joe, that makes sense. And that's part of the Governor's Department of Economic Development.
Yeah. They're doing a great job. And I think it's going to attract the bigger ones, too, like Y Marshalls. I mean, that's Taylor Sheridan.
Yeah.
It don't get bigger than that. Kevin Costner with Horizon. And I've had actors that have been cast in speaking parts in those. And that's a big deal for these people to really build their resume. And then they could go to bigger markets if they want to.
Yeah. So we're going to back up just a moment. You had mentioned Sundance. So it is leaving.
Yeah, it breaks my heart.
Yeah. So what effect might that have on outside Utah films coming here to shoot? You mentioned a little bit you think people are still going to come here.
Yeah.
But do you think having Sundance Film Festival in northern Utah brought filmmakers to the festival and they looked around and said, hey, I got to shoot my next stuff here?
Yeah, when you think on those terms, yes, because maybe they weren't aware of the beauty of the geographical location and what it offered. But I think it's not going to stop people. John Ford was coming here.
Yeah. Yeah.
People were coming here far before Sundance because of the beauty of the locations. And I think they're aware now that there's a savvy cast and crew and there's tax incentives. Yeah. So I don't think it's going to stop. We might have lost one or two that could have been, but I don't think people are going to see any effect on that. I think what it's going to affect is the people who relied on that influx of people coming in to watch films. And that's where it's sad to me. And we all love films. Sundance was a great part of Utah. And but there's some other film festivals that are really trying to do a good job. The Zion's Indie Film Festival with Marshall Moore and his wife, Michelle Carpenter, this is the 25th year anniversary. They bought it a couple years ago. They're doing a fantastic job of marketing that. I've had probably 16 or 17 films in that festival over the years.
Yeah, I imagine there's some film festivals around the country that are talking to the city people here.
You bet.
Trying to take that place. I would love to see it, a great film festival in April.
I would,
where
too.
People are not slipping and sliding on the ice.
Yeah, and I think that's going to happen. But I don't think it's going to stop production from coming. People are going to come here to make their movies. And if we continue with a few other festivals, I don't think anything will ever replace the magic of Sundance and what Robert Redford did. He came here to make movies because of the locations. And then that's how Sundance started because of that. And so my hope is that, it just continues to thrive. And I don't see why it won't.
Can we ask you to provide us with a list of films and where to screen them, where your films and where people can screen them, so we can add that to the website when we post this story?
Yeah, a couple films that you could watch right now is Lucy Shimmers and the Prince of Peace. That could be on, you can see that Amazon Prime, Tubi, Peacock. Shadow of Vengeance is a throwback vigilante film that I did. That's on Tubi now and Amazon Prime. Love Everlasting is a coming-of-age love story that I really like, kind of, in A Fault in Our Stars Walk to Remember, Amazon Prime. And then my upcoming movies, I don't know yet. I'm about to find in the next couple weeks, but I would think it would be, you know, either Amazon Prime, Tubi, Peacock, Netflix, some of those usual suspects that I anticipate happening.
So. Now, you had mentioned that you are also an agent.
Yeah, I own an agency called Rob Diamond Agency, where my assistant, Crystal, she sends actors out on auditions, and they book all the time. We just got a big audition for Y Marshalls.
Nice. So we have the Egyptian Theater. They have a youth theater program.
Awesome.
And how could, if, let's say there's someone they want to try film from the
theater.
They
could reach out to me. I've been teaching film acting for 25 plus years of all age ranges. They could just reach out to me if you have my information on your website, Rob Diamond Films, or they could email robdiamondfilms@gmail.com. My phone number's everywhere.
Good.
I have actors that I train all across the country. I'm very passionate about teaching film acting. Theater's great. Film acting is a different approach, I believe, and that's my specialty is film acting.
Excellent. So. Well, we just spent the morning with Rob Diamond, filmmaker, owner of an agency, writer, director, the whole works. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. We'll be right back.
Tyler Anderson is the founder of Urban Sailor Coffee. Urban Sailor recently opened its third location right here in Park City. Tyler's here to tell us this morning, tell us about what they have brewing this morning and every morning. Tyler, good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Roger.
Tyler, tell us a little bit about your background and sort of the career that track that sort of led you to Urban Sailor.
So I had a long tech career for about 27 years, and I think during the COVID pandemic, a lot of people were second-guessing their futures and deciding what they wanted to do with their lives, and I was one of those. And I took stock of what I kind of wanted to do at the end of my career. I'm in my 50s. I've got four adult sons, and one of them wanted to be in restaurants and cafes. And I thought, you know, this might be an opportunity to kind of invest in him and do something that I'm a little more passionate about.
And what's the term Urban Sailor come from?
Yeah, that's a long story, but I'll shorten it as much as I can. I basically had a buddy that I used to rock climb with in Seattle. He owned a boat. He worked on boats, large boats, and he had a big sailboat that didn't have a main mast. It was damaged, and that's how he could afford it. and so it sat in a slip in Lake Union, which is, if you know Seattle, is right by downtown Seattle, so you see all the skyscrapers. And we couldn't take that boat into open water, but we would unhook it from the moor and float around and drink whiskey and called ourselves Urban Sailors.
Without sails up.
Without sails.
You know, as I was preparing for this interview, I think I went to your LinkedIn profile. And your career is kind of interesting. I mean, I take it you started out selling cars?
Yeah, that's correct. I didn't plan on that. But after a finance degree and no one was knocking on my door to run their finances, I decided to try selling cars for a while. And that led into a whole career in automotive. But it was good timing for me because it was like the mid-90s. And so I got into the internet side of things. And I ended up working for several ad agencies agencies that kind of represented the auto manufacturers. And that was that led me to Seattle, actually, in the late 90s, which is where I kind of fell in love with coffee.
Nice. So the significance of the name, we got that. And your first location, I understand, was a motorcycle.
Correct.
Coffee bars. Yeah. Was it also called Urban Sailor?
Yes.
So Urban Sailor riding a motorcycle. Is that still around?
It is. Originally, the idea that I had was to build it around my son, who is a barista and a bartender, mm-hmm. and make it so that it could be potentially just a small business for him. But I knew branding and marketing and stuff, so I came up with the logo and the brand, and we bought a motorcycle together. So his name is Archer, we're partners in the business. He's now 25. At the time, he was like 21, 22. Mm-hmm. So Yeah, I thought maybe that was as far as it was going to go. We built out a Ural sidecar motorcycle. It's an old Russian motorcycle. Yeah. We put a walnut countertop on it. We used boat finish, so it was legit, you know, sailor. And we went from place to place, mostly downtown Salt Lake. And so that kind of felt like the urban sailor name fit.
Okay, so you would actually use it as a portable coffee bar.
Yeah.
You drive around. And how would you power, you know, the stuff you need? I mean, you got to have power to make coffee.
Yeah, it was actually tough to source the right kind of commercial equipment that could keep up with demand on, right, on a busy coffee bar, but also run on standard power, because all these commercial machines that we put in our shops, yeah, run on 220 power. And so we found the right equipment. And so if we had access to shore power, we could plug into a 120. I'm still a boat guy at heart.
Yeah, yeah.
If we could find power, we would use that. But if we couldn't, we had a generator we would use.
So you stuck a generator down by the feet of the sidecar?
We would move it as far away as we could. We had a 50-foot cord.
How often do you still take that out? Do you still take that out to special events?
Yeah, we do. In fact, Park City's been on my kind of radar since we did the Kimball Arts Festival 4 years ago. We did Kimball Arts Festival in 2021, and we were up on Miners Park in the kind of the upper Main Street, and we had a line of about 60 people the whole 3 days. And I was like, you know, people up here seem to really get what we're doing. And so we still do events like that. We actually did City Weekly's Beer Fest last weekend downtown in Salt Lake.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you said that people get what you're doing. What are you doing? I mean, there are lots of places to buy coffee. There are lots of places to buy coffee. I mean, well, what's special?
You know, I do have to sometimes just remind myself, it's just coffee. Just relax. It's just coffee. But I could really geek out on how amazing coffee is and how deep you can go down the rabbit hole. I would say I've been a coffee connoisseur, kind of geek for, you know, 25, 30 years. And so I really like these kind of like high cup score, natural processed coffees from places like Ethiopia and Kenya and others. And so I've been buying that kind of coffee and making it at home with a nice espresso machine for years. We wanted to try to bring some of what I'd experienced when I traveled for business, you know, in Europe, New York, L.A., places, Seattle, that were kind of pushing the envelope of coffee a little bit more than some of the places in Utah were. And I thought, you know, we'll try roasting more Nordic style, which is a lot lighter than most coffee shops roast. And that's kind of what I preferred. And we'll see if other people get it and other people like it. And I wasn't sure they would, honestly, but they really do.
So let's do a little bit of tracing what has to happen here. Beans. You got to start with the beans.
Yeah.
How do you find the beans and where do you find the beans?
Yeah. So I have some sourcing partners that I work with. Most of the ones I work with are at Royal Coffee in Oakland, California. But I work with a few others as well. And we have some direct relationships now that we're trying to foster. But coffee is like wine, and you're right above a wine store. They have what's called Q graders, and they grade the coffee and they give it a score of 1 to 100 or 0 to 100. Anything over 80 is considered specialty coffee, and so if you hear that term, we're a specialty coffee shop, it means they should be serving only coffees that are scoring above 80. We're buying consistently coffees that are in the high 80s and low 90s, so those are significantly more expensive. You can taste the difference if you're if you roast it well. If you over roast it, you're gonna not really taste the difference.
It's gonna be burned, right?
Yeah, you're gonna taste, you know, the char of that.
Yeah, what's that place that makes that kind of coffee?
I can't remember. Anyway.
So we like to kind of like, if you liken it to steak, we like to kind of think that we're cooking our steaks, you know, medium, maybe medium well sometimes, but sometimes medium rare. We're never cooking them well done.
And how many countries are you currently bringing in beans from?
Seven right now.
Yeah. Seven countries?
Yeah, seven countries.
Through Oakland, though?
Yeah, through Oakland.
Okay, but you want to get...
We have one direct relationship in Brazil.
Okay.
But most of the other coffees are coming through our distributor in Oakland, yeah.
Okay, nice. So seven different kinds of beans. They come in big bags. I mean, I really want to get a sense of how this thing works.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we all go in. I think coffee comes in cups, right?
Yeah. We've been roasting for the last 3 years in the back of the Mountain West Hard Cider Distillery in Marmalade part of Salt Lake. So west, kind of northwest Salt Lake. And we had a big dock and, you know, everything. So we could get these huge trucks to kind of pull right in and drop these big pallets of coffee bags. We've coaxed the local delivery truck to come up in Iron Horse Drive right by Mercer Auto and drop one for us. And we do have a storage unit there. And so, you know, we store some coffee pallets right there. But yeah, they come on, you know, they're like 1,200 pound pallets of coffee. Each bag is about 150 pounds. We do about 10 to 12 bags on a pallet.
And it's raw.
Yeah.
The beans are raw.
Yeah, it looks kind of greenish yellow. Yeah.
And you roast up here also?
Yeah, so we moved our roaster from Salt Lake City to Park City just a couple months, like 2 months
ago. So your main roaster is now here?
Yeah.
It services all three?
Yeah, all three, yeah.
So you roast here, and then you ship it down to your other stores.
Correct.
And then you grind there.
Yeah.
And are there different grinds?
Yeah, for sure. We grind a little more coarse for drip coffee, and even more coarse for cold brew, and then really, really fine for espresso. And they actually require a different grinder for espresso because it grinds almost like powdered sugar.
So we're getting coffee from all these different places. Who's the lucky person who tries to figure out the ratio of the different the different beans to make what you want? And do you have multiple sort of blends that you're serving at any point in time?
Yeah, we do, is the short answer. And what's fun is, I think coffee, like a lot of things, is a real good combination of science and art. And I'm lucky enough that my oldest son is very analytical, very focused, and so he's really good at the science part of the roasting of the coffee. I think I bring more of the art side of, like, okay, let's see what the Q grader said the tasting notes naturally occurring in this bean were, and let's see if we can combine that Sumatra with this Guatemalan and see what that does, because this one has chocolate, this one has this. So I'm kind of working up the recipes of the blends, and he's making sure that the roasts are just technically perfect.
Wow, it kind of sounds like the Willy Wonka version of coffee, right?
Absolutely.
Where you're experimenting in the lab. And the best part about this is I bet you get to drink a lot of coffee while you're experimenting.
Yeah, sometimes too much. When we first started this 4 years ago, I bought this hand-built espresso machine from Italy that I thought at the time was really expensive. It was $7,000. It's a little one. And now, you know, we just put a $31,000 espresso machine in this Park City location. It's my perception or my paradigm shift. But when we bought that, I was like spending all this time dialing it in and trying to get the perfect shot. And I realized that, yeah, my heart was racing. I was tapping my feet. I'm like, I gotta slow down.
Now, what about so you had a career in tech before this.
Right.
AI can't put notes into AI and say what you want, and then AI will make the blend for you?
So that's a very interesting question. I do think we're starting to see that happening. I'm starting to use AI in certain parts of my marketing things, and there's a lot of potential. My son and I have this conversation once in a while. We think that it's a matter of time, and probably a short amount of time, before AI is starting to help roasters come up with the perfect roast profiles.
Yeah, so you get your Q number from the coffee.
Yeah.
And then a temperature and time for the roaster. And AI just kind of runs it, and that would be interesting.
Yeah.
An AI attached coffee roaster, grinder, espresso maker, all in one.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a big proponent of technology, and I love things that kind of help save time and reduce mundane tasks and things like that. But at the same time, I'm also, we've really leaned into kind of like the craftsmanship of coffee, and we don't want to lose that. And so we're always kind of balancing that. Like,
so it sounds as though coffee is obviously the central theme of the coffee shop, as opposed to these places that are more broad. Let's talk a little bit though about the range of coffee products you offer. When I walked in this morning, I could look up at the menu. What was up there?
So I would say we have a little more of a traditional menu than you might find at a lot of coffee shops around Utah, in the sense that if you order a macchiato from us, we'll explain that a macchiato is a very small, like a 4 ounce drink, like it is in Italy. Mm-hmm. There's other drinks too that we offer that you don't see on a lot of menus, like a flat white, which is...
What is a flat white?
It's a lot like a latte, but you're steaming the milk differently so that it's not as foamy.
So is it like it's like a three-step? A flat white is the minimum steam, the latte is the next step, and the cappuccino is the...
That's correct, okay. Yeah. Okay. And then basically a macchiato is kind of like it's a little different than this, but it's kind of like a very small cappuccino because it's got a dollop of foam, which is similar to the cappuccino foam on the top of an espresso shot, yeah.
Okay, so then we have that range of coffee products.
Yeah.
Teas?
Yeah, we carry Stephen Smith tea out of Portland. Mm-hmm. We really like their teas. They have kind of an Earl Grey equivalent called Lord Bergamot that we think is really good. It makes a great London Fog. Okay. And but we carry some other herbal and some natural teas.
Foods?
We are sourcing pastries from two local bakeries. We'll be using the bake shop, which is at Kimball Junction in right by Hearth and Hill.
Is that called the bake shop or the bakery? The bake shop. Okay.
Yep,
yes.
Yep.
Okay.
And they're phenomenal. And we're working with a couple of other local bakers as well. Right now we're still kind of dialing in the right mix for Park City. We're going to try some breakfast sandwiches.
That was my next question. Yeah. Are you going to have some breakfast sandwiches or even some lunch sandwiches?
Yeah, for sure breakfast sandwiches. We're not sure about lunch sandwiches yet, but we'll see if we can do that as well.
And one of the things that people find attractive about coffee shops is they're kind of fun places to hang out.
Yeah.
And I noticed this morning as I walked up, there were people I knew on the balcony. There were people I knew in the shop. Is it a hangout?
It is. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, you asked, like, what do people have to get about your thing? And part of it was the coffee. But part of it also is I missed the really nice coffee shops that I used to go to in the 90s in Seattle. Not just some of the corporations, but even some of the local coffee shops have kind of gone more to drive-thrus because you can make a lot more money making the drinks much faster that way. And people do like to stay in their car, especially after COVID. But I purposely chose my three locations that had no drive-thru. I don't want a drive-thru. I want a place. I want a community place. I want a third space. We've kind of leaned into the listening room. I don't know if you saw when you were there. Like, we have vintage speakers, turntables, reel-to-reels. We want to be like a place that people want to hang out.
Wasn't that an old music shop that had a turntable? I think that. Anyways. Different
okay.
point. Now, here's a question. So if someone is having a coffee drink, let's say it's a latte with caramel stuff in it and whipped cream on top, all that,
yep.
Can you use a lower grade coffee because you can't taste the coffee after all that?
The answer is yes.
You can? Okay.
Is that like the vodka and a screwdriver, like you can't tell?
There you go. Yeah. I mean, I like my espresso just as is.
Yeah.
I used to have a latte, but now it's just espresso, so I make sure it's just really good beans because I can taste it.
Yeah, you mentioned the menu, and we have a pretty small, limited menu. Compared to a lot of coffee shops, we keep it pretty simple. And the largest drink you can get at our shop is 16 ounce. So
You don't have funny Italian names on them. You actually tell them how many
ounces
it is.
Yeah, we tell them what they are, yeah.
So you can say small, medium, or large?
Sure, yeah. Exactly.
And not get corrected. Corrected. All right,
No drive-through, but do you have order ahead if you are in a hurry?
If you go to our website, you can order ahead, and that'll pop up on our screen for the baristas to see that, hey, there's someone coming in 15 minutes that's coming to grab their drink. So you can, and we have, you know, four drink carriers and things like that, so they can come in and just grab their drinks and go.
And now you have to go on the website. Can you call? Because if I'm in my car and it's like, you know, I got a meeting to go to, I should grab some coffee.
You should be able to call. I haven't figured out the phone situation quite yet. Everyone's in the front bar, and so I didn't want to have people answering the phone in the front bar. So we're actually working on a solution that'll actually take orders using AI.
There you go.
Using Siri.
Yeah.
Okay. Using Siri to do all that. And okay, so we know where you're at.
Yep.
We know where you're at. And so what are your hours? 7 days a week?
7 days a week. We're 7 to 3 on weekdays right now, and we're 8 to 4 on the weekends. So Saturday, Sunday, 8 to 4. It's the same hours that we have in our Sugar House location, and we've tried different hours there for, you know, 4 years, and those seem to be the hours that really work the best. We are considering pushing the hours out a little further, especially as it gets into fall and ski season. Yeah.
Have you thought about doing any evening, you know, coffee shop, music kinds of things?
We think about that a lot, and excuse me. Yeah, part of the reason why we designed the spaces that we have in the way that we have and kind of made them dark and moody is because we do like the idea of maybe having some wine and charcuterie boards and stuff on the weekends. And so we're looking into getting a wine and beer license.
A license,
yeah.
Very good. Anything else you want to share with our listeners?
Website.
Yeah, so it's urbansailorcoffee.com. And our Instagram is basically the same. It's just at urbansailorcoffee.
Wonderful. And he brought some coffee
again,
in.
It's the building is the old Ritual Chocolate?
Yeah, Ritual Chocolate.
Ritual Chocolate.
Yeah, on Iron Horse.
On Iron Horse, right in front of Mercer and sort of across from
Windy Ridge
Windy
Cafe.
Ridge.
Yep.
So that Anybody who lives here knows where that is.
Knows exactly where that is.
A lot
exactly.
of people seem to know where Billy's Barber is, too.
Yeah. So down the road from, and across right the street across, from Billy's. Yep. So, and is there enough parking for people, or are most people walking or biking?
There is parking. Obviously, parking gets tight, especially on a Saturday and Sunday there, I've noticed, when we have a lot of people in there. There is some overflow parking between us and Mercer, and so it's marked as, you know, overflow for our building. And so there's usually a little bit of room down there near Mercer as well.
Okay, Tyler Anderson of Urban Sailor Coffee. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for bringing us some coffee.
You bet.
We'll be right back after this.
So let's say you've got some friends or family from back east coming in for a visit, and you know they'll want some gin and tonics. Maybe you don't drink gin and don't keep it in the house, so off to the liquor store for some gin and some tonic and whatever else goes with it. But the liquor store only sells alcoholic beverages. What will you do? What will you do? Lucky for you, you're listening to today's episode of Mountain Money, in which we'll learn about mixers and more. We are joined by Polly Bakova and Crystal Deakins, the proprietors of Mixers and More. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Hello and good morning.
Hello, good morning. Thank you.
Yeah, so is that true? State liquor stores in Utah don't sell non-alcoholic beverages?
That is absolutely true. The liquor stores are intended to keep track of the alcohol that is in the state. It's all held in a warehouse in Salt Lake City that's then distributed to the different state-ran liquor stores. And so in order to not monopolize on everything, they only focus on the alcoholic beverages and not the mixers, syrups, bitters, or alcohol-free beer or wine.
Okay, and this is where you come in. The gin and tonic person can buy their gin at DABC and come see you and get the rest of what's needed. Tonic, limes.
Tonic, limes, martini mixes. If they're doing a gin martini of any kind, we've got a variety of different flavors to go along with it.
Do you sell olives.
What was that?
And the olives.
And the onions?
And the onions.
Nice. But vermouth is alcohol, so you don't have that.
No, we don't have the vermouth.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's say I'm on vacation here, right? And my hotel room doesn't have a kitchen, just a little hotel room. Do you have knives, cutting boards, so I can cut those limes to make the gin and tonics?
Not yet.
Okay.
We are very responsive, though, to requests. So we write them down on our whiteboard, and at the end of the week, we go over it and decide if we want to purchase a new product, too.
So let's talk about the range of products you have. Obviously, what are the mixers that people commonly ask for, and what are the odd ones that you stock anyway?
The most common mixers have been either a margarita mix or the espresso martini, and of course the old fashions. Mm-hmm. And with old fashioned, you can have a smoked old fashioned or you can have the classic old fashioned. The smoked old fashioned, you'd want to use like a rye whiskey to it because of that peppery smokiness pairs well together. But we also have, if you're here for just a few nights and say you get yourself a little pint of vodka, if you're feeling like you want a cosmopolitan and an espresso martini, we have single serve packets that you can do each of these different drinks. So you're not locked into, I have one mixer bottle and I'm going to drink these all night long. No, you can have a variety, the spice of life. So if
I'm that vacationing person, I can come in there and get packets of flavors that will cover my entire week.
Absolutely.
For my après-ski.
Absolutely. We've got Moscow Mule. We've got Margarita, Old Fashioned. We've got Paloma. We have a number of really interesting flavors. The original from Leisureman's, it's got a black licorice to it. So similar to adding a hint of Jaeger to your drink. it's not for everyone, I'll tell you that. Yeah. But there are some people who do love their black licorice.
And then what about equipment? What kind of equipment do you stock? Do you stock shakers and things like that?
Yes, we do have shakers. We have a variety of shakers. We have a variety of glasses that have 8 to 10 different cocktail recipes on them.
The glasses have the cocktail recipes.
Yeah. So we have one that's for mocktails only. We have a tequila one, a whiskey, and a vodka. They haven't quite come out with a gin one because gin people are simple. They like it easy.
Gin people are simple. I love it.
And corkscrews are very important.
Lots of people get
their wine and don't have a corkscrew.
So I imagine what else goes with wine? Do you have decanters or those aerators?
We don't have any aerators, no, but we do have a variety of dark chocolate to go with the red wines.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And then for the lighter rosés and white wines, we would recommend either a white chocolate or a milk chocolate. And we carry a number of different chocolate bar brands. The one that's been the most popular has been our Moody bars. It's just because they have a little face on them. They each have a different little flavor, but Hungover seems to be the most popular.
And we're diving into the Dubai craze. So we got 3 or 4 different types of Dubai chocolates as of today. Yeah. And one of them is single serve packets. So you get a little chocolate in plastic. So you can put that in your pocket when you're skiing. Give it a try. But
that's
we
fun.
Loved the fancy one. It has like a crispiness to it and it melts and it smells really good.
Boy, it sounds like someone really enjoys figuring out what to buy on the chocolate side.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just my impression. Okay, so let's talk a little about you guys, okay? Like, this is not something that pops up on everyone's career trajectory to open a mixer store. Tell us a little bit about each of your backgrounds and what led you to this.
100%. It was Crystal's bright eyes finding this opportunity.
Tell us about it, Crystal.
So I worked actually directly downstairs at the Sweet Alley Liquor Store, number 36, from December until about May. And in that height of the ski season, you see a lot of great tourists coming through, and you'd have to break their heart by telling them that they've got to go 1.5 miles down the road to find some mixers to go along with their alcohol they're getting. And they're like, I don't want to do that. That's too far. I don't have a car. Well, the bus will take you there. I don't want to do that. So the idea started to come up. And honestly, it was an idea between me and two of my coworkers. My boss, Jake, and Michelle, we were joking, saying, you know, if I had $1 million, I'd open a mixer store in town and help everyone out with different things that they asked for, because you did get a lot of interesting requests at the liquor store. Beef jerky was definitely an option. I'm like, well, we don't have that. That may be on the horizon for us. But, you know, wine openers.
Yeah.
And plastic barware, things of that nature. So we started to get into a list of different products to carry. And I proposed the idea to my good friend here, Polly. And she's like, you know, I am on board with this idea. And so I started to do market research of what's the best snacks to carry, some sweet snacks, some savory snacks, what mixers. We carry 4 different brands of mixers that use very clean products that are very clean ingredients, meaning no high fructose corn syrup in it. They're using real cane sugar in it. And just going with the top of the line, what we could find, especially with the alcohol-free wines. Some people, when they think alcohol-free wine, they think, oh, it's bottled grape juice. And we're here to change your opinions on that, because we've had some wonderful options and flavors come through. We have the Wild Child from Sovi, which is a sparkling orange. We showcased that on our grand opening, and it tastes just like if it were to have alcohol. It's a nice, refreshing, bubbly, that's in the mixture of like a rosé side, but it is a sweeter one for
sure. So speaking of opening, when did you open?
The 18th was our grand opening, and we opened officially on July 24th, Pioneer Day. So
totally appropriate.
We're really new to the scene, but we're happy to be here.
So Polly, let's hear a little about your background as well.
Yeah.
My family immigrated from Russia, and so I've always been looking for opportunities for the American dream.
There you
and
go.
Tried and failed a few times. Was a high school teacher for a year. Met Crystal about a year ago at a startup company, mm-hmm. and got laid off. That was not a good time to be laid off right now. The job market's pretty scary.
So you jumped into this with both feet.
Yes, absolutely.
And talk to us a little bit about when you're opening a store like this, what are you doing to get yourselves on the map? I would assume you've talked to your friends who are at the liquor store downstairs, but what else are you doing? How are you going to make the tourists aware of where you are and how to get there?
I think our most effective way to get people has been talking to the customers, like really taking in who they are, what they're doing here, and then they kind of tell about themselves, what network they have in the community.
Have you reached out to some of the concierges or any of the other the lodging houses? Because those people are obviously very important in terms of getting tourist education.
Yes, we have started to reach out to the concierge service, such as with Marriott that's right next to us. And then we've left messages with a few others, and we'll reach out back to them because they're limited on their hours during the shoulder season.
No, I bet if you take them some chocolate, that might really help.
Oh, absolutely. Chocolate is always a good bribery. Food bribes everyone. You just got to find the right kind of food or beverage for that matter. But we've reached out to a variety of our friends and family, former coworkers and colleagues in different industries. We've had a number of great business owners come down to see what we have, the different restaurants. We have handed out flyers to the visitor center, and we have...
What about social?
Social, we have an Instagram, we have Facebook, we have TikTok, we have
a website where you can order online and pick it up, or DoorDash.
I was going to say, have you lined up with DoorDash or some other delivery so that, I mean, yeah, your ultimate tourist model is I'm sitting in my, you know, rented home in Deer Valley. I've been drinking my scotch and I need some mixers. I don't want to go out. I will pay if you bring it to me, right?
Exactly.
We do have a DoorDash that will pick up from our store and deliver to people, but we also have reached out to the different delivery services for grocery deliveries. We've had, I believe it was the Grocery Girls and the Delivery Express that have stopped by to see what we have and to be able to help bring that into the different customers' homes, too.
So, now, exactly where are you located? It took me 20 seconds, but...
Yeah. We are located down just past the Lucy Moosey on the left side of the gateway from Swede Alley.
I say under the Crooked Clock Tower.
Under the Crooked Clock Tower, perfect. And you're inside the Gateway Center itself on the south end.
Yes,
across from the handle.
Yep. Oh, right across from handle.
Yep.
Perfect.
From the across from the handle's private room.
And do you have a website so people can find you?
We do. If you were to go to mixersandmore.cloveronline.com, we have a little map on there that shows you a pathway of where we're at. And then you can get a good view of all the different products that we carry.
Wonderful. Hey, we just spent a few minutes with Polly Bakova and Crystal Deakins of Mixers and More. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be right back after this.